I'm Paul Qualia, the Director of APAC Assistance. It's Monday, 10th of December, and I thought I'd just give a quick overview of some of the main issues affecting ASEAN and the Southeast Asia region. Firstly, I want to look at Indonesia. Last week saw some mass killings of construction workers in a tribal area called Nduga. It's in the western half of the island of New Guinea. It's in the Papua province of Indonesia, which is the most extreme right or east of the Indonesian provinces. It's alleged to have been by separatist Papuans. Many soldiers are deploying into the Nduga area to hunt down the killers. Papuan protesters are scheduled to conduct a demonstration on the 10th of December, and this is to oppose further deployment of soldiers into Papua and specifically into the Nduga tribal area. They're demanding a third-party neutral investigation into the killings. Now, why is this important? What is Nduga? Why is it relevant to the wider social and economics of Indonesia and indeed internationally? Freeport is a national strategic asset of Indonesia. Therefore, it's protected by the military. In Papua, there is a massive military deployment, which Western military analysts would perceive as being extraordinarily excessive for the relevant threats there. In the Indonesian system of looking at their threats, they have a National Resiliency Institute. It comprises hierarchy of military and civil societies of academia and major relevant ministries. Within that, to try and overcome many of these community disputed areas, they have a very elaborate establishment of doctrine for conducting community policing. Apart from the BP Teluk Bintuni region, which is the large gas project in what's called the Bird's Head region of West Papua, which is the second most eastern province of Indonesia. Apart from there, there has been no establishment of any professional community policing systems. The community relations is also quite centralistically controlled and quite backward or primitive in its level of influence and capacity. So, Nduga, why is that important? Nduga is one of the six highland tribes that are in the highland area where the Freeport McMoRan mine is. The Freeport mine used to be, until a few years ago, the largest mine in the world, and it is soon to be the largest underground mine in the world. And we're looking at production there in terms of how much ore is processed, of about 300,000 tons of ore daily. Now, that is bigger than many economically or commercially viable mines will produce in a year. So there have been many shootings recently in the Freeport area. There have been both expatriate and Indonesian victims, and indeed victims within the security forces. The major incident of note, though, was the shooting of international school teachers in the Freeport area in 2002, where they basically went for a picnic and they were ambushed military style. Now, many analysts believe that Papuans would not attack Westerners or Western teachers, certainly not in such a planned manner. Now, 16 years later, the massive security force from the army deployed into that area, into the Freeport area alone, still struggles with what is pretty much a low-level group. Their training and capacity of these alleged Papuan groups is indeed, you know, they're a primitive group. They're not trained. They don't have weapons unless they capture them. And fundamentally, to struggle with a group of this capacity leads to conspiracy theories that are they really a separatist group, or are they indeed being created to justify a larger than necessary deployment. Obviously, next May is going to see an election in Indonesia. We are still tipping a very, not necessarily a landslide, but an extremely comfortable victory to the incumbent, and Prabowo's not making much headway. So fundamentally, we're saying that the Islamic-related parties are losing influence, and that Jokowi's going to win unless there was a tragic sliding in the currency value. In Malaysia, the International Convention on the Elimination of All Forms of Racial Discrimination continues to be a big issue. We refer to that as ICRD, or ICERD for simplicity. It is the 1965 UN Human Rights Treaty that calls on governments to erase racial discriminations. Now, tens of thousands of supporters of the United Malay National Organization, you may know it as UMNO, and the Malaysian Islamic Party, which is often referred to as PAS from its Bahasa acronym, held a massive rally on December 8. Now, the rally was supposed to thank the government for not ratifying ICERD. However, organisers are believed to be using the rally to show continued support for the United Malay National Organisation and the Malaysian Islamic Party from Muslim Malays. The chairman of Malaysia's Human Rights Commission said the agency will continue to work for the ratification of the International Convention of the Elimination of All Forms of Racial Discrimination, quite a mouthful, that one, and five other UN treaties, which he said do not really threaten the privileges the constitution grants to Muslim Malays. Flipping to my favourite piece of politics in Southeast Asia for the last 20 years or so is Thailand. And the election remains the focus, or the main focus at the moment in Thailand. The military government has affirmed and reaffirmed February 24 as the date of the election. Now, here it's probably salient for me to mention that the military government, it's in place because of lack of integrity and lack of capacity amongst civilian political parties. Now, this comment is valid to all the previous non-aligned military parties and the new parties that are aligned to Thaksin, and the main opposition parties that aren't aligned to Thaksin, such as the Democratic Party. Sadly, there has been a lack of governments, a lack of unity within each political party. Whether they're in government or opposition, there has been a lack of governance capacity. What is even sadder than that is there's been, particularly by the Thaksin-related parties, a disgraceful lack of governance, integrity of government, and appalling and consistent abuses of power by the parties, particularly the Pruithai Party and its various incarnations. What many people in the West and analysts both in Asia and beyond describe as a coup is perhaps better described as, in this case, as a necessary intervention. When we look at some of the abuses by previous governments, we're talking the transfer of hundreds of millions, perhaps even billions of dollars of national assets into companies whereby the Thaksin family were the ultimate beneficiaries. So, you know, there's this belief that he was being trumped up and unfairly dislodged. It's not the case. People need to look at why the current military government, with the support of a royal family that's given great stability to Thailand, has elected to allow a military coup, or indeed to orchestrate it. A Western-style democracy, Thailand is most certainly not. That the ban on political activities will be lifted soon, albeit more for show than for real go. The current main non-military aligned parties are continuing to protest the military government and the Election Commission's alleged bias for pro-military parties. That said, Prayut's a master strategic mind, and he's got Thailand's best welfare in place. On the other hand, Thaksin, who's obviously outside of the country, is a master strategic player. But behind his feigned philanthropy is a desire for power, for wealth. The best interests of protecting Thailand's their rich culture, their unique architecture, their proud history, and indeed their wonderful cuisine is not Thaksin's primary focus. These are the things that make Thailand the ninth most popular place to visit on Earth, with visitor numbers approximately about 32 million a year, which is close on half the Thai population, and thus make tourism a critical part of the economy. And despite media and Western analysts stating the economy will be destroyed by a military-run government, the economy continues to expand at a tad over 4%, which if we look at other major economies around the world, is quite okay. Add to that, the Thai society is generally supportive of the stability and governance that is currently being displayed by the military government, and also that the government has broken the ongoing, never-ending squabble by pro-yellow forces in what's become really a comical and kid-like series of self-centred and obstinately styled protests. And the people of Thailand are actually welcoming the new government, and all the polls show that they actually are impressed by both Prayut, who's the preferred person that they want to see as Prime Minister, but they also, as a Thai society generally, very happy to have stability of government and government governing. Now, where I am at the moment, Singapore has recently had some territorial disputes with Malaysia, both from a maritime and an aerial perspective. The two countries have expressed a willingness to settle their ongoing incursion disputes through negotiations. They've yet to set a date and venue for that, but between the maturity of the new Malaysian government and the rock-fast and steady-fast Southeast Asia government of Singapore, this is not an issue other than of interest in the news. It's not going to create any instability. And the Philippines, on the other hand, the government has proposed a third extension of martial law in Mindanao until the end of 2019. Now, some senators said President Duterte will be calling a joint session of Congress on December 12 to officially present the proposal. The proposal is expected to be granted with less lawmakers voting for it. Many senators in particular are opposed to the proposal because martial law has not stopped Muslim terrorism and communist attacks in Mindanao. So a lot of them feel that it should be in very, very specific areas. Mindanao is a very large geographical area. And they're worried about, well, if you really need to declare martial law right across Mindanao, is there a further motive to use excessive force, and is this going to creep across the Philippines? In Cambodia, the Prime Minister Hun Sen is considering reversing a five-year ban on opposition politicians. The move is reportedly prompted by the European Union's threatened move to deny Cambodia access to duty-free trade. The reversal of the ban is now being considered after it has served its purpose, which was fundamentally ensuring that Hun Sen got elected during the elections and obviously gave himself a real chance to be re-elected in a landslide when he had banned all the other political parties. So that's a quick recap of Southeast Asia. I hope you found it helpful. Thank you.